Welcome to this special episode of Osmosis Cast with me, Callum Morris, him,
Jamie McMillan,
and our wonderful, wonderful guest,
Lauren Bailey.
So, spoiler alert, we've already done this episode. We are recording this after the fact because I forgot to hit record. So we are redoing an introduction. We're going to give our wonderfully esteemed guest a chance to introduce herself again, as it was not recorded the last time. And then at some point, there will be a cut. And hopefully that cut will give you a little bit of context as to our previous conversation. And you'll see me go as I realise that we're not recording.
We're definitely recording this time though, right?
We're definitely recording this time.
I can see the little bar going up, so if it's not recording this time, it's Jamie's fault.
Unbelievable. I don't believe it, because it was a two-part error, this was.
Yeah, this was...
It was your part and it was on my part. Oh,
yeah,
my God.
All of the audio problems.
And it all fell apart.
Yeah. So Lauren and I know each other quite well. She's my little cousin. But she's a far more esteemed science person than I, in my opinion. Lauren, tell us a little bit about you. What are you doing on Osmosis Cast with us nerds?
Well, as an avid listener, as you know, jumped at the chance to come on. So my background's in science. I have my bachelor's degree in geography, where I focused on doing species distribution models of the Polybius arcus species at a fine scale, which is the silver-studded butterfly species. And then I did my master's in conservation biology and ecological management, and my thesis in that was using public policy as a pathway to net zero. And yeah, now I focus, my job is all on environmental hazards and public policy. So
Lauren, what inspired you to get into science? Were you bullied at school?
No. That's for another podcast.
Hang on, we did establish that you and I are family, right? Before I just hit you with the, were you bullied at school? Because...
Yeah.
I don't know if you did.
Well, you know, our family experiences, you know, like that's one of the reasons I kind of fell into this kind of career, I guess. Life.
Yes,
style,
I remember this from the last time we recorded it. Yeah. Tell me the anecdote again. Give it to me.
So there were kind of like two experiences that really, you know, inspired me to sort of go down this path. And one of them was when Callum and I were a lot younger, probably, I think I said 20 years the last time we recorded. I actually looked, it's more than that, plus 25 years ago.
Jesus,
we went
Christ.
On a family holiday to the Isle of Wight. We were there, we went to sort of like a cliff edge, just wandering around on a walk, and there was a house there that had been eroded away from due to coastal erosion, and it was literally hanging off the edge of the cliff by like a couple of branches and some root system. And I remember thinking at the time, like, that's crazy. How is that possible? And why would you have built a house there if you knew it was going to go? And so many questions.
It's such a bad idea.
Yeah, like, did no one see this coming? So that really inspired me. And then the other one, I think we can probably all remember, especially sort of...
Well, you and I, hopefully.
Kind of age group. Yeah, is the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004. Sort of, you know, everyone kind of gets together at Christmas and then we have that sort of breaking news. And I remember watching it, and even as the first sort of aftershocks were coming in as well, and just thinking, this is absolutely
wild.
Yeah, absolutely crazy. I just wanted to know how everything worked and like, why was it causing such an impact? Like, what sort of mitigations were in place? Is this something we should be more concerned about? Is it a frequent occurrence? Is it not? And that slowly drove me down that path, I think.
Amazing.
Nice little regulation perspective as well. Should we be regulating this more? That's what I picked up there.
It was a foreshadowing for your future career.
Very much so.
And we're back. This is Jamie in post. We're back to the original recording now. Sorry for the mess.
I'm really sorry. I've not been listening for like 30 seconds. I just tabbed into my OBS and I was like, I should probably check we're recording. And I'm not recording, but my application and my audio input capture was set to the wrong things. So that might be a minor issue. Jamie, I'm hoping you're recording Discord audio as well as your own audio. Oh my God. So from this timestamp, I'm back to normal. I'm so sorry. I didn't listen for the last literally 2 minutes because I was having a small meltdown.
Unbelievable.
Take it away, Jamie. It's all good now. It's all good now.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Just the excitement to jump in. This is the problem.
I was too excited. That's the problem.
I remember undergrad and postgrad, they were a bit difficult. And I don't think they were web-based. I feel like since then, just by doing it, I'd like to think I've got better. Whenever I go on stage for like a public appearance, I can't get over the belly feels. Like, it always hits me.
So Jamie and I did drama.
Ever since drama, back in school.
Yeah, I wondered. Did you,
always the same, never gone.
Do you think that helped, though, being on stage when you were a kid?
Even if that's just recognition for, oh, you're about to go on stage. Yeah, you're going to feel like this.
Yeah. I think those feelings are okay. I mean, I would say there are certainly days, you know, I almost feel like being a teacher is doing a performance sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, if I've had a really crappy, you know, evening or a bad night's sleep, I still have to smile, you know. I still have to be cheerful and welcoming and yada yada, and that sometimes feels like a performance. I agree with you. I think doing that drama back then probably did help with that regard.
See, I did drama in GCSE, but I found that harder than doing just like talking about my own area of things. I feel like it's much harder when you're putting on a performance, whereas when I'm going out and talking about something that I've been researching for like, you know, a good couple of months, I'm like, oh, it's almost second nature now.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
And I wonder. Sorry, go on, Jay.
I was just going to ask, what are some of your highlights from being in front of people, talking, communication? Do you have any fond memories of? What are your favourite moments that you've had?
I've done so much public speaking at this point. Like, my undergrad really focused on science communication. Mm-hmm. And if I thought my undergrad did, my master's was all about, like, different ways you can explain things to people. So I did loads of presentations. I did the classic, like, posters in a conference.
Beautiful.
I did making videos as well. Classic pandemic learning, I guess. But I think probably the ones that stand out the most was doing my presentation for my undergrad dissertation, and after like literally researching this for months and months and finally getting to stand up to it, because a lot of people, they kind of get like dribs and drabs on your course of like what you're actually researching, but everyone's so focused on their own stuff, no one actually has the time to really sit down and learn what you're doing. So that was a good time to finally be like, right, I know it seems like I had no plan, but actually, look, it's all come together. And I was looking into something. And it was kind of that nice recognition between, for both myself being up there, but also when my peers went up and did their own presentations, being like, oh, like, when you mentioned, like, microplastics, that's what you were doing. Like, that's actually really interesting. And then I did a lot in my master's that were good. I did if we could apply for a grant to research anything, what would it be? And we had to like create a big poster, and then you got interviewed by different lecturers, and it was meant to be a bit of a combination of what it's like being at a conference, but also like having to, you know, sell yourself and your research to get grants. And that
did you
was
do
good learning?
Did you do bid writing as part of your course?
Yeah.
That's a life skill. That's a really life skill.
At the time I was like, this is, like, I want to be, like, learning, like, lab skills. But actually, and the guy that, or the lecturer that ran the course was like, this is so important, though. These are things, like, you need to know how to write, like, a proposal for something. You need to know how you're going to plan your whole research. And what's the point of doing that if you actually can't get funding to do it? Like, where are you going to look for funding? What people are you going to go to? So the whole course was literally, or the whole module was all about all those sections to get your research
such a dry topic, but it's absolutely amazing.
I never did anything like that at university. I mean,
I didn't either.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a hell of a lot of time like in the lab. That was honestly the overwhelming majority, especially in like dissertation year. It was just lab and then results. We didn't do anything about like funding and stuff.
So I didn't really do a lot of
like
lab
real
work.
Real life of science, yeah.
I did a little bit.
Yeah? I imagine you did a fair bit of field work. You were out and about.
Yeah, I did a lot of field work.
What did
and
your field
main
work
bit
look
of,
like?
Well, kind of here, there and everywhere. From So I studied at the University of Exeter for my undergrad, but I went to their campus in Cornwall. So it was a lot of going out to like St Ives, West Penwith, Newquay, Gadrevy, basically all the really nice beaches, and taking data samples there, or some old coal mines. We did some stuff along there as well, like rivers near coal mines, and measuring like the levels of toxicity in the water and stuff. And then the big trip was in my last year of my undergrad, we went to California. And we did some data collection in Yosemite, and then the human geographers went down to Santa Cruz, and us physical geographers went up to the Sierra Nevada to some really isolated research base and just did experiments all over there, which was amazing.
That does sound dreamy.
It's like it's like proper life experience, isn't it? It's so amazing.
And so that was some good lab skills as well.
Yeah. I really want to talk a bit, and this might be a bit of a dry topic, but I don't think it. I think we'll keep it less dry, right? I want you to touch a little bit on where you talked about doing like policy writing and stuff. I would love to know, and you talked about like getting to net zero. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, maybe what net zero even means for people that are listening to this, that maybe are not scientifically minded, and sort of how your journey led you there and what you think needs to happen next. There's quite a lot of questions there. Sorry.
Loaded.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite a loaded question. So net zero is the idea that the amount of greenhouse gas emissions we are putting into the atmosphere, we are taking out of the atmosphere at the same time. So, you know, like to put it into like, you know, if I had 5 coins and I'm putting it into my bag, I also take 5 coins out and the net amount in my bag is still zero. So it's that kind of idea. And it kind of came about, we as the UK and part of when we joined like COP26, which is the Conference of the Parties, which is a big climate conference, part of that, we signed up to the agreement to try and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the way we did that as a country was we made it a legal obligation to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions as a country across all sectors by 2050, which back when I was doing, like first learning about this, that felt kind of close, but still like kind of way off. And now we know, you know, 25 more years and we're there. So
it's around the
closer.
Corner.
Yeah, I think it's getting harder. I feel like the conversation 5 years ago on it is not what the conversation is now around it. I feel like people were really in support of it, but you know, it's a hard one to like not really talk about, but I don't want to like dwell on it. But like politics has like been swings and roundabouts over the last couple of years. So you get other countries and even our own country, you get people come in that really, really support this and want to work on it. But, you know, you might then have another leader that doesn't necessarily want to work on it. And like, you know, America's a really good example. They completely pulled out of the Paris Agreement, which is part of these commitments. So, and that does just set back research. Yeah, it just does. That's the reality of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely hard, but I think ultimately the people that are always interested and know how important it is, like in the science community and outside of it, still push through it and still think it's a really important point.
So can I throw a take at you? So I feel like, obviously, I think there's a pretty solid consensus of people that have a science background or sort of have, I don't want to say understand, because I think that sells the knowledge of people that don't accept it short. And I don't necessarily think that people that disagree with it are stupid. I, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm gonna bring up flat earthers, bro. No, listen,
subtly put, Callum.
A flat earther, though, they're in their minds, their science is sound. Like they feel like they are the expert. So even though they're incorrect, they still feel like they've done something rigorous. Do you know what I mean? I've kind of forgotten where my point was going here. Oh, yeah.
You're so distracted by flat earth.
I am. I got really distracted there. As a geographer, you'd love that, wouldn't you? Flat earth.
I'm fascinated by the whole... But the history of maps is really fascinating, and it just blows my mind that people
the history of maps
do
is
still
fascinating.
Believe.
It is really fascinating.
It is fascinating.
How do you make a sphere a square? Something's got to give.
I don't know.
But yeah, it's
I've really gone off my question.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
It's
your
completely
point
lost
is gone.
Now.
We've lost your train of thought.
Carry
Lauren,
on.
So you were, if we're talking net zero, I was interested in... where do you feel the balance is between, like, you've got technology on one side, like, great, innovation, that's lovely jubbly, but that's not solving everything. What's the interface between technological advancement and then policy? Like, is it just do technology, just do policy? Is it, how do you
I think it has to be
see
both,
it being managed?
It has to be both. I think that, it's such a dangerous era, I personally think as well, is there's so many people out there that really do believe the science, but also really believe the science is going to save us entirely and just be like, well, you know, in like 10 years, someone will just invent something and it will just completely revolutionise us. And I'm like, that's great. I hope that happens.
Maybe.
But shouldn't we be planning, in case it doesn't, shouldn't we be thinking of other things? Because we don't, this technology ultimately doesn't exist right now, you know? Yeah, as you know, if you watch Back to the Future, we should be having hoverboards by now, and alas, no hoverboards.
I did see that film.
I love that you just brought up hoverboards.
I do.
Jamie, you get the reference. So Lauren is the one that keeps requesting hoverboards. And she got maglev trained. Deal with it.
I did enjoy it, to be fair.
Good.
I enjoyed it, particularly where you're like, it's, you know, even if you get data wrong, it's still data, like, it's still valid. And I was like, not wrong.
Data, should we say that? I don't recall.
No, I don't remember that.
I don't recall this morning, so.
It was Jamie, so.
Derek.
I need to clip that. That can be our first Instagram
Yeah,
reel.
Absolutely.
You need to give me a timestamp.
Boy.
Yeah, I feel like talking about the climate is so doom and gloom sometimes. And I've kind of remembered my point, so I was gonna throw it, but I was gonna throw the question out. It's like you know when you're told, oh, make sure you're recycling, and you like get shamed by your community or by your neighbours if you don't like put out your recycling bags. Do you feel like, because my kind of thought process on this is that climate change needs to be top down. It needs to be policy down. So I kind of feel like, sure, every single person on the planet could turn their TV, or, you know, turn it off at the wall instead of leave it on standby. But ultimately, if the policy doesn't change, we're going to be screwed anyway.
I think you have to look at where the largest contributors to pollution are, and it's not.
Yeah, but even that argument... Yeah, okay, sure. I thought you were going to say the UK then, but you're right. It's not the public. It's
well, it's, yeah, just within the UK scope. Let's not. Yeah.
I think it's kind of like everything. It's a bit of both, you know? Like, policy doesn't
But I'm just
change.
Wondering, like, what's the weight? What's the percentage? Like, if every human being on the planet didn't leave their
70,
telly 30, on standby...
quote me.
Yes. I'm assuming that the people are the 30, is what I'm saying. The public are the 30. I feel like it needs to come from elsewhere.
But a lot of what drives the change at the top level is individuals. It's that classic thing, you know, like one person going against like a big system doesn't make a change. But if everybody went against that system, we would see real change. You know, look at when Silent Spring by Rachel Carson came out.
Punk band.
Sorry, please carry on.
Sorry.
We're waxing lyrical about your words.
When Silent Spring by Rachel Carson came out, a whole generation of people read that and it really resonated with them. It made people think, oh my God, like, her big point in the book was, you know, one day you'll open your windows and there'll be no sounds of insects, you won't see anything. And people sort of stopped and thought, I already, and I'm sure you've seen it as well, because I definitely have, you know, there just are less insects around now. Do you remember, like, when we were kids, you'd go on a drive and you'd have all insects on your window, like, screen? That never happens anymore. Mm-hmm. But her book, it really resonated.
That happened to me the other day. It was disgusting.
I mean, I'm kind of, like, not mad about that, because I'm not a big, like...
No, you don't really need
appeal to me. But also, I'm like, it's very sad. And it was a really good form of, like, science communication. It was really digestible for people, and it made loads of people, just ordinary people, not even scientists, read it and think, we need to make a difference. And that actually led to the chemicals that were causing, you know, a lot of pesticides at the time were banned. So it needs to come from both. There is no one size, no silver bullet solution here. It is everyone needs to be doing their bit, whether it's people at the top and people at the bottom. You've got to work together to sandwich the problem.
That is a great
I feel like, yeah, it needs to be policy driven in the sense that it needs to be,
but people need to do their part as well.
Needs to be imposed on companies. I'm not even thinking about the people. It just needs to be imposed upon companies through regulation. So
I think it's important. It's
some
communication, understanding.
All right. Have we got anything else other than climate?
Let's move swiftly on. So I have in my notes storm chasing. I want to hear a story of you chasing a storm.
I've seen tornado chasers.
Yeah,
I mean, lifelong dream, really. Like, again, 1996, year I was born, best film came out, Twister. Twisters is also in cinemas now, not sponsored, but
have you seen it?
I saw it literally last night, yeah.
Mate, nice. give me your rating out of 5 stars.
Ooh, I would go solid 4. I was, like, pleasantly surprised by it. Like, I was really, like, Twister is one of my favourite films ever, and I was really, like, hesitant, like, oh, like, do I want to spoil that? But a lot of my friends that are, like, meteorologists and storm chasers were like, no, like, actually, it is quite good. You've got to give it a watch. So I went yesterday, and, like, someone, like, ultimately, there's always a bit of science fiction, because, you know, that's got to drive the plot, it's got to be exciting. Mm-hmm. So that, for me, I was like, I was just sitting there like, oh, this just wouldn't work. This is not how it works. But take that away, and actually there was some really good nods to the original film, and there was some really good explanation of severe weather that you don't really get in the original film. And I think now, you know, we've got better models, everyone's got a laptop, like there's literally apps to, like, track storms with, and that was all kind of in the film. That's, and I thought, cool. That was a really nice present take on it. So
that's almost like a form of, it's like a form of science communication, isn't it? Any layman that sees that movie will have a better understanding of extreme weather. I love that for you.
And it absolutely is, though, because when they first did the film, and they've done it this time as well, they had consultants that actually were from, like, the National Weather Service and all of those, the big bodies in America, because they were like, the main thing is, okay, it's kind of a science fiction story, but it's all about actually teaching people, what do you do in a tornado? Like, if there's a warning going off, what should people be doing? Where is the best shelter? Like, how should you be reacting?
I wouldn't have a
and
clue.
Admissions after, gotta watch a film, admissions to meteorological courses in America after Twisters spiked, after Twister in 1996, they spiked the course admissions because people were so drawn to it. So yeah,
I wonder if there was a spike in chemistry after Breaking Bad. I'd be interested to see.
Got to be.
There must be, surely.
Yeah, there has must to be.
Show me that correlation.
Yeah, I want to see a graph. No, that's cool. So have you, I take it you've actually been storm chasing?
Yeah, I went last June. So not this year, June of 2023.
All about it.
All across Tornado Alley. Yeah, so I flew into Colorado, Denver, Colorado. Started there.
Lovely.
And then I went down to, like, first day, they're like, oh, we've got, like, some supercell activity on the border between Texas and Oklahoma. Just spent all day driving down there. I mean, we left at, like, 9 and we got there at about 5 in the afternoon, so like a whole day of driving. Chased around for like 5 hours, seeing lots of supercells, but none like producing tornadoes, but it was a really good introduction. And then after that, we spent time driving up through, we went everywhere. We went up through Oklahoma, Nebraska, Montana, Wyoming, more of Colorado. So literally all the way up, basically to the Canadian border and then back down to the Texas border, which is crazy, in like a week.
I'm interested. What gear do they have? I'm thinking what measurement instruments do they have? Like what are the instruments you use to measure things?
So a lot of it is just done off of like the weather models. So like they're open source, loads of them are, and all that the weather service in America and stuff, in the morning they run the model like pretty regularly throughout the day and they upload it all. So the first thing you kind of do in the morning is you have like a briefing and they'll put up the different models and be like, okay, like, well, there's this area of like storms kind of moving in and it's got like, you know, like looks like it's gonna have some good wind shear and good like precipitation and all these kind of factors you need, and they'll be like, that looks kind of good, and maybe there's another one over here but we don't think it's going to be quite as strong. So like, you know, it's kind of using our best judgment, what one do we go for. And then other than that, I mean, it's pretty much just get out there and see it with your eyes. It's quite cool actually, because if you see tornadoes, there's like a number you can call that like sends a message to the weather service to be like, I'm in this location, I've just seen a tornado. So there you can actually influence like the real live tracking of things as well, which is quite cool.
That's really cool.
Nice.
But yeah, mainly so laptops and radios.
I'm assuming those models are based on satellite imagery. That's what I'd assume. Do you have any insight there?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of sort of on the ground, like weather stations reporting like current conditions, like a lot of satellite imagery as well, especially like tracking like cloud movements and build up and things like that. So it's a combination.
It's really cool. Remember being a kid.
If it wasn't clear, I'm pro satellite imagery.
I was going to say, I remember being a kid and thinking like tornadoes were really, really dangerous, but like I thought they'd. I remember when I was a kid, I'd like it would be windy and I'd be like, "Oh, careful for a tornado." I didn't like grasp that we don't really get them in the UK. It was that and like you know the like big tarmac rollers.
Well, you mean like I'm trying to think of the name of the tarmac roller from Cars. It's like Bessie or something. Are you talking about Bessie?
I'm going to Google Bessie Cars. I'm not sure. Maybe. Bessie Cars.
Tarmac layer.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. Yeah. I used to think... No, so...
It's tornadoes. Come on.
No, because my brain went, tornadoes, I thought they were really common and dangerous when I was a kid. I also thought tarmacers were like responsible for a lot more deaths than they actually are. I don't know. That's just where my brain went this day.
That is a wild, wild link.
I don't get it either.
I mean, you say that we don't get a lot of tornadoes in the UK, but like for like our land size, we get like the most in the world. For like
How
our
come?
Size of our country.
What?
And where are they?
Well, they're not... Them. So when you think of tornadoes, you're thinking of the ones you get in Tornado Alley. You're thinking of like EF4, EF5.
I'm thinking
big,
of twisters.
Yeah, no, you're smaller, much, much smaller.
Are you
like,
telling me I've got tornadoes wrong?
Well, we had tornadoes last winter. We had one up in Manchester. There was one on, was it in Jersey or Guernsey? One of the islands
really?
In the Channel had one as well. Yeah, but they're very, very short-lived. And normally in our weather, when we kind of, like, the way our sort of weather system works and the time they kind of move in, they, like the ones that happened this winter happened at night. So it's really hard to like actually see, and it's all done by like the kind of damage you're seeing. And then, you know, retrospectively looking back at models being like, well, actually all the combining, the factors you needed were all there and look at the damage we saw. But we do get them, they're very short-lived, not majorly destructive, which is why you rarely hear about it.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's today I learned as well. Very good. Very, very good.
Oh, nice.
I mean, I'm happy to move on from storm chasing there if you guys are. I want to talk about turtles. Because you mentioned your big conservation interest. What did you do with the turtles?
So I've had many experiences, luckily, in my life with turtles, and it kind of all culminated in me being like, one day I really want to go and see turtles, like the hatchlings, like all coming out of the nest and like go into the sea for the first time. So actually, in between my undergrad and my master's, I went out to Kefalonia, like one of the Greek islands, and spent 3 weeks there, basically camped out on beaches at night, monitoring the nests for when they hatched, helping hatchlings make it to like the sea, doing outreach during the day with like some of the tourists, talking about like the turtle life cycle, the importance of like conserving turtles, and then doing harbour monitoring as well. So I would go, if a turtle was spotted in the harbour, we'd all like go down and like sort of check the health of the turtle, if it needed medical attention, taking it to the vets, and then more general stuff as well while I was out there. Like, obviously, it's not just about turtles, it's about the whole environment and conserving them. So we would do beach cleans, we would do gradient measuring along the nesting beaches to see how the
Jamie has perked his ears up.
The sites.
Gradient measuring?
Talk to us about gradient measuring. That sounds sufficiently nerdy.
So, yeah, basically, when you think of a beach, you know, you kind of get some like nice kind of like shallow sloping beaches, some like really like steep sloping beaches. But it's kind of hard to like imagine it, especially, but what kind of beach that we have, I guess, like especially where we live with our pebbly beaches. But especially with sandy beaches, you get like really big storm systems or really intense wave action. It can literally be eroded away so quickly. So something that could have been, you know, a couple of meters back from a high tide, or it's like quite high up, suddenly, like in a big storm, all the sediment gets washed away, and actually you're now at risk. And you see it a lot with dune systems where they start failing, like that kind of reduces the grading of the beach. And yeah, in Greece, it was a lot of like their winter storms when they came. So one summer they'd have like, oh, I've got a beach, and like there's loads of like nesting sites, it's a good way back from like the waves, be fine. You get one, and obviously like turtles return back to the beach as well. So they, you know, winter then happens, you get all these storms, the gradient changes like really dramatically, and suddenly these turtles come back and they'll nest there, but they're not really good nesting sites anymore. But you can see like small gradient changes just throughout the year anyway. So we kind of, we would go and we'd collect data and sample there just to see how it was naturally changing as well.
So out of interest, what is sort of the ideal for a turtle then? What would be the ideal beach?
Sandy.
I thought that was a good question. Did you just say sandy?
Sandy beach. Don't want a pebbly beach.
Oh, Lord.
I thought that was a great question. There's a serious answer to it, and that would be away from light pollution, actually. That's the biggest issue. Is that a lot of these lovely beaches in Greece, beautiful locations, turtles love them, humans love them, loads of beach bars. So you've got all this really loud music, you know, lots of like vibrations on the sand can, so turtles mass hatch. So if one starts coming out, that little bit of vibration kind of works its way through, and suddenly you'll have, instead of having one turtle hatch, you could have like 100 hatching at once. Like it's, wow. It's really intense. But the vibration of people nearby, that can get them triggered. And then when they come out, obviously they're meant to be following the moon reflecting on the water. That's how they know where to go. But if you've got all these like bars with all their lights and stuff up, they end up wandering all into the dune systems and all over the place. And it's really sad.
So I remember when I was a kid watching like shows about turtles, they'd always make a point of, we mustn't intervene with nature. But by the sounds of it, people regularly intervene because we've already done so much to put them at a disadvantage.
I think that's the thing, like turtle numbers are, or have been for like most of the species, been declining for some time now, and without intervention you are just going to lose these species, because you know we're building like beachfront homes, so that's less beaches for them to go to. We're putting bars up and, you know, creating all this noise and all these lights, all these distractions, so more of them aren't even making it to sea. And let's say they do get to sea, you know, we've got boats in the water, we've polluted the water, you know, the numbers getting to adulthood are so minimal. And then, you know, they've got to keep reproducing throughout their life cycle. And it's just diminished so much that there is a point where you're kind of like, you know, we've got to give them the best chance we can. I mean, we didn't literally pick them up and put them in the water. What we would do is we would dig trenches from the nest down to the water so they had a clear path so they couldn't wander. Because also it's part of, you know, of the ecosystem. Some turtles have to die to feed the other species. Not every single one of them is meant to survive. But, you know, if you kind of left it to do its own thing, you might find 40 turtles in your bar instead of in the water. So got to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Ecological management. Yeah, that's tough.
Definitely.
But it sounds lovely, though. That sounds like a great experience.
Oh, it was great. There's like, it was beautiful.
So I'm conscious. So we normally try and keep our episodes about 45 minutes. We're at 40 right now. So we do need to think about wrapping up soon, but I do want to touch on one other point that you popped in your MISC notes. So for any audio or visual listeners that haven't figured it out, Lauren is a female working in science. Talk to me about that. What sort of female specific challenges have you faced? Because obviously I'm a dude, Jamie's a dude, maybe not obviously, I guess, but we are. You know, we can't empathise or really understand from your POV what it's been like. So talk to me about that.
I think there's always the classic, like, sometimes you come up against people that are quite, like, naturally big personalities. And I think just me and some of my peers, like, you do kind of find, like, you're kind of shunned away a little bit. We're not necessarily the loudest group in the room sometimes. But I think sometimes that's just not having the opportunity to be there in the room that's the problem. But I think, at least in my case, I think I've been really lucky. So when I was at uni, my course was actually like 51% of people on my undergrad were girls.
I found
had a great
well.
Mix of like, yeah.
We had
there's a lot more, and
girls.
A lot of my lecturers were.
Because I always thought it was really masculine, like doing science. Then I got to uni and it was all girls. Sorry, carry on.
I did physics and I was probably closer to an 80-20. And I do physics now. Yeah. And it still feels like a 90-10.
Yeah. I think it's definitely not across the board, I don't think.
No.
And
field specific.
I think it's almost, you almost bring it upon yourself. There's so many people that I've spoken to that are like, oh, well, you know, you might find it interesting, but it's a really male dominated field, like that'll be really awkward for you. And even when you're trying to empower people to be like, of course you can go and study it, but it will be challenging. And it's like, that's just, I think that kind of puts people off. Because like I say, like, yeah, you're not, like, I'm not always the loudest person in the room. I'm kind of like, I'll wait my turn to talk. I'm not going to be put that person that shouts there, but I'd still rather be in the room and be able to give my opinion than sort of be put off from the start and be like, oh, don't even bother.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think it's great. And I, you know, when Jamie and I started doing the podcast, I said to him, I want to be able to talk about like GCSE level stuff in case, you know, any of my students want to do some revision, I can say, oh, check out that episode, we talk about it there, or something like that. So I think, you know, my school is a mixed school, but we only get intake, we don't choose our intake. So last year we were effectively an all-girls school with one boy. And I think of some of the girls that I had last year, and obviously the ones that we'll have next year. And I think it'd be good for them to see some representation as well, because I think it is, you know, I think the perception is that it's more male dominated.
And I think part of it's down to, again, comes with, you know, growing up, the only female scientist I was taught about was Marie Curie. That was it. Everyone else was a guy.
I love that woman.
But I think we're definitely getting better, you know, with all these new films and documentaries and stuff coming out all the time, and podcasts talking about it, that people are looking into female scientists and what they did. Like, there's some great films out there, especially about, like, you know, the NASA missions, and a whole host of other issues as well about minorities and how actually, like, you know, people from literally all walks of life have done stuff, and we should be giving them a bit more, you know, praise for the work people have done. Credit where credit's due.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, I think that's a lovely sentiment there. It's good. So, time check. We can probably start to wrap up if you guys are happy to do so.
Please.
Yeah.
final thoughts from me. We always do little final thoughts at the end. It's been absolutely a pleasure to have you come sit down with us after a busy working day. As I said, Laura's my little cousin, so we get on pretty well, and it's been lovely to have a talk like this. It's been really, really nice to have you.
Nice. This has been great. I've enjoyed this.
Nice.
It's been refreshing, man. And it's been really nice to talk to somebody.
It's been lovely.
No, I don't like talking to you, Callum.
That's right, I'm not offended. Lauren, I'm going to throw it to you for the final word. No pressure, but if you want to do any, I don't know if you have a page or something that you want to shout out.
Oh, is it shout out time?
Like
yeah,
sure. We can do that.
I think we shout out to Lauren's blog.
Do you have a blog?
Yeah, she's got a blog.
You got a blog?
I do have a blog, yeah. God, that is a throwback. How did you find Jamie, that?
Jamie did say to me, I'm going to go and find out what I can about Lauren Bailey on the internet.
Oh my gosh.
he did utter those words.
I mean, you will love it. I have a whole blog post on there about things they mentioned in Back to the Future that we don't have, including hoverboards. It's a passion project of mine, clearly. I'm actually a lot more passionate than I thought it was about this, but... Yeah, no, it's
maybe
been good
you're
fun.
In the wrong
I mean,
field.
Again, listen to it all the time. So, I mean, yeah, I need to change.
Nice one. Well, I guess on that note, thank you very much from me, from Jamie, and from Lauren. And we will see you. We will hear you. You will hear us next season, in season three. Ooh.
Looking very forward exciting. To it.
Exactly. Let us know if you enjoyed having Lauren. We'll bring her back if you did. Thank you very much, everyone. See you later. Good night.
See you later.
Thanks.